The headlines, a Russian investigator says a Pentagon and some U.S. companies have spent millions of dollars on developing Ukraine's bioweapons program since 2005. The Yemeni army says it has shut down a Saudi spy drone over the northwestern city of Hajjah. West South Korea says neighboring North has fired an unidentified projectile off its east coast. Hello and welcome, everybody. It's our top story. For this half hour, Russian forces pressing ahead with their military operation in areas in eastern and southern Ukraine. The Russian army has carried out a major attack on a steel plant in the southern city of Mariupol, where UN brokered evacuation operation is underway. Moscow says Ukrainian troops are using the break in fighting to take up combat positions in the city. More than 150 people have already been evacuated from Mariupol. In the Donetsk region, local authorities say attacks by Russian forces killed 21 civilians on Tuesday. Meanwhile, the European Union is preparing fresh sanctions on Russian oil sales, but there are divisions among member states, with Slovakia seeking exemption from the embargo. A top Russian investigator says the United States has been involved in Ukraine's bioweapons development program. Alexander Bustrykin says the analyses of obtained documents show representatives from the Pentagon and certain American firms have been involved in biological military activities in Ukraine. The Russian investigator says Washington has spent over $224 million since 2005 on such programs in Ukraine. He says the sum has been funneled into about 30 research centers run by Ukraine's defense, health, and agricultural ministries. Russia has long accused Ukraine of pursuing a U.S.-funded bioweapons program. That amid Washington's allegations that Moscow could launch a chemical attack on its western neighbor, a claim the Kremlin vehemently denies. Former U.S. Army psychological warfare officer Scott Bennett says American and Israeli intelligence operatives have been engaged in biolabs in Ukraine since 2005.
We knew over a year ago about these biolabs and their experiments and the documents. We knew about the contractors. We knew about it originally starting in 2005 with the Defense Intelligence Agency that then created a 501c3 called the Global Viral Forecasting Institute with a Zionist Mossad operative named Nathaniel Wolf that then became Metabiota, to make it more of a harmless name. And that Metabiota was being funded by Rosemont Fonseca, an investment firm that, ironically enough, Hunter Biden, the son of Joe Biden, was the head of, along with Christopher Hines, who was the son of John Kerry, and Paul Pelosi Jr., the son of Nancy Pelosi. So this is a incestuous, corrupt, criminal racketeering operation that the West has been developing under Obama, under Biden, under, for the last 10 years, for the purposes of generating DNA biological chemical warfare to use against the Russians. That's why they've been collecting DNA samples from Slavic people. And of course, all of the documents and the evidence that General Igor Krylyov has found and commented on are all being exposed as revelations of a massive, really war crime against humanity, because it's a violation of the Global Biological Chemical Weapons Agreement.
Yemen says its air defenses have shot down a Saudi spy drone flying over its airspace. According to Yemeni media, the drone was downed over the northwestern city of Hajjah. Yemen's military has already brought down dozens of drones operated by the Saudi-led coalition in recent years. The incident comes amid a UN-brokered ceasefire agreement reached between the warring sides on April the 1st. Yemen says the coalition has on multiple occasions violated the truce by launching attacks. And North Korea has reportedly test-launched yet another missile amid worries on the Korean Peninsula over its nuclear program. The South Korean military has been quoted by the media saying that an unidentified projectile was fired toward the sea off the North's east coast. No further detail is available, but the North Korean leader recently vowed to accelerate the development of his country's nuclear arsenal, calling it a symbol of national power. Kim Jong-un also said that the North would not shy away from the preemptive use of nuclear weapons to counter hostile forces. This year alone, North Korea has fired multiple short and long-range ballistic missiles. The country has doubled down on Kim's military modernization drive as well as missile tests while ignoring the offer of talks from the United States. Our Seoul correspondent Jennifer Chang joined us earlier with details about North Korea's missile and nuclear programs.
We have to see what kind of missile this is, and those results of the investigation will come out later. However, just last week, the North paraded its Hwasong-17 monster ICBM, which the U.S. missile defenses are helpless to stop. This missile can hit any point in the U.S. with a nuclear warhead. And so this is going to be what the focal point will be. The North had fired a missile, an ICBM missile, which it said was the Hwasong-17 last month, but the U.S. and South Korea claimed that this was not the Hwasong-17, but the Hwasong-15, an earlier version. And Pyongyang is eager to show that it is indeed firing off the Hwasong-17. Now, the Hwasong-17 is different from the Hwasong-15 because it has multiple warheads and decoys that can evade any U.S. missile defense systems.
Welcome back. China is taking more precautionary measures to contain the spread of COVID, with the capital Beijing shutting down dozens of subway stations and bus routes a day after the city recorded 51 infections. Authorities have gradually begun imposing restrictions, and people fear they would face sudden stay-at-home orders. Housing compounds with reported infections have already been locked down, while tourist sites are tightening their rules and restaurants closing their doors. The central city of Zhengzhou has ramped up controls, with residents in some areas remaining in their housing compounds. Officials say the measures are aimed at avoiding the fate of commercial hub Shanghai, where millions have been under strict lockdown for over a month. China has been battling its worst flare-up since the early days of the pandemic. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has admitted that the government has not done enough to alleviate the pain of a growing cost of living in the UK. During our News Review program, we discuss the economic crisis in Britain. Let's have a look.
And I welcome everyone up News Review, a program where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. The British Prime Minister says that his government cannot provide enough financial support to ease the pain of the current cost of living in the country for months ahead.
Because I accept that those contributions from the taxpayer, because that's what it is, taxpayers' money, isn't going to be enough immediately to help cover everybody's costs. Of course that isn't going to work in
so you
enough
acknowledge
in the
you
short
are not
term.
Doing everything
there
you
is,
can.
There is more that we can do.
Yes.
But the crucial thing is to make sure we deal with the prices over the medium and long term. Although you're quite right to point out that there is an inflationary risk and it's very severe, it could get worse. And that knocks onto interest rates, and that knocks onto the cost of borrowing for everybody. And I'm sorry to say this, but we have to be prudent in our approach.
Johnson rejected the prospect of raising welfare benefits in line with inflation. He argued that such a measure can easily drive inflation even higher. The Prime Minister also rebuffed the idea of windfall tax on oil and gas giants, saying the move will discourage energy companies from making investments. Now, Britain is grappling with soaring inflation, which hit a 30-year high of 7.5% this March. That, coupled with the war in Ukraine, is taking a toll on the British economy. Surging prices are contributing to the biggest squeeze on household incomes since at least the 1950s. Retail sales and consumer confidence have fallen significantly in recent months. And now joining us for the program is Tony Gosling, historian and journalist from Bristol, and Daniel Lazar, journalist and author, joining us out of New York. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. I guess we'll start with you, Tony, out there in Bristol. Hope you're safe and doing well. Always a pleasure to check in with you, Tony. So, Tony, the you know, situation we're seeing in the UK, it's not, you know, basically exclusive to the UK. You very well know it's kind of a worldwide issue. But when it comes to the UK, do you think it goes back to, it might be a mixture of them, but or a combination, I should say. But do you think, what is it pertaining more to, the COVID pandemic and the supply chain issues that it basically elicited, possibly the Ukraine conflict and the energy costs from that? Or is it Brexit, or is it Johnson's administration and their handling of, you know, the nation's economics?
Well, look, we've got is a disaster in the economy here, really, where a lot of people have been forced onto state benefit handouts, and Johnson is now saying that they are not going to rise alongside inflation, which is a total disaster, because these benefits are designed to be a bare minimum subsistence level amount of money for people. So what he's effectively saying is, we are going to be driving you below the poverty line so far that you will not be able to do the basic things like feed your children, for example, to be able to turn the tap on and get water out of it. All that sort of thing is not going to be possible, because the benefit levels are at subsistence level, and he's saying that they won't rise in line with inflation. This is a total disaster for the quarter or so of the population who are dependent on these benefits. And the reason they're dependent, answer your first question, you have to go back a lot further to find why, because it was really back in the 1970s and the 80s, in the Thatcher era, where Britain basically ceded its industrial policy to Brussels, and we basically started shutting down all of our industries around the country, because we thought, oh, this is great, you know, because we can get the stuff cheaper from abroad. Well, of course, the fact is that you're not making sure that you've got a good manufacturing base, a good job base that your people can rely on for an income. So that's been the big disaster here, is that there's been a structural problem over many years. So we're in a situation now, just let me tell you, that, for example, in our city in Bristol, there are no public toilets, very, very few, maybe one or two privately run, for-profit toilets. And so you end up with basically human excrement being found on the street every morning around our city. This is, I'm afraid, where we're at now, because there's been a complete lack of public investment and a mismanagement of the economy. Ever since the David Cameron government came in 2010, all these things started to go, because central government stopped funding local government. But look, at the same time, what we've got is these obscene amounts of money being spent on other things, such as British Petroleum, BP, it's a firm which Iran is very well versed with, you know, because it had a history with Iran. Their profits, just the first quarter now, $6.2 billion in profits. And that is around about $25 billion annual profit margin. So what's happening is, really, these massive multinationals are dictating policy. They're now more powerful than our governments, and the governments are, I'm afraid, selling the people out as a result. Another thing, just today, across the Atlantic, you know, a similar problem over there, but Biden has just announced $33 billion to help the Ukrainian army hire mercenaries, hire private military companies, buy weapons to fight Russia for them. And so the money is going in all the wrong places, and the people are basically being sold out and forgotten by our governments. It's not surprising, is it, that the people like Boris Johnson have such a low, and Biden, by the way, low approval rating. And in Britain, you know, you'd expect the opposition Labour Party to be doing really well out of this. But unfortunately, they have been supporting most of these policies by Boris Johnson, his COVID policies. Also, I mean, saying he should have gone much further to destroy the economy, and also with Ukraine, that he should be sending more money to Ukraine. So we don't have an effective opposition either. So I think really what we're looking at is, you know, a kind of disastrous, it's a fascistic system we've got now, where these big corporations have got far more clout than any of the ordinary people.
And Daniel, that's the thing, that's an age-old argument, isn't it? Even Republicans feel like that in your neck of the woods. Across the pond, they feel, you know, increasing welfare also drives up inflation. And now we have a lot of British lawmakers that feel the same way. Is that a cop out, or is that the case in your point of view? And if not, even if it is the case or not the case, perhaps, is there a more equitable way to produce jobs, getting the poor into better jobs, a more sustainable jobs, and getting the working class to improve their living standards?
Of course. I mean, first of all, the what's caused inflation is that the central banks have been shoveling cash onto Wall Street or the City of London to keep speculation going, and financial speculation has hit absurd heights over the last 12 years. And real estate values have been pushed up, which has pushed up rents, and now inflation is spreading from financial assets to ordinary commodities. So that's what we're seeing. The war in the Ukraine is central. The U.S., Britain, other countries are essentially, allocating billions of dollars to supply arms to the neo-Nazi brigades of the Azov Battalion and other such forces. This issue has been ignored. The press is burying it. The governments don't want us talking about it. But the more the war drives up inflation and causes real hardship in the broader population, the more explosive this issue will become. I mean, essentially, why is the UK and the US providing military aid to neo-Nazis in the Ukraine? I mean, the Battle of Britain was just 80 years ago. And that's when you had Nazi planes dropping bombs on London and other cities. Now the British government is helping neo-Nazis get back into power in the Ukraine. That is outrageous. It is causing hardship among British workers, and it has to stop, and I'm quite confident that it will stop.
All right, gentlemen, always a pleasure to check in with you both. Stay safe, and thank you. Tony Gosling there joining us from Bristol, and Daniel Lazar joining us out of New York. And that's a wrap for this segment of your news review program. Thank you for joining us, and bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. Without conditionality on human rights or a mechanism for accountability, how can an enhanced trading relationship be understood by Israeli regime as anything other than support for its violations and war crimes? Dear listeners, this was part of an article written jointly by Sarah Hosseini and Mazen Masri Writers. This article is published under the heading, UK Trade Deal with Israeli Regime Sends a Clear Message. Apartheid is rewarded. Here's the story. The UK's Department for International Trade is currently considering public submissions ahead of negotiations for a new free trade agreement, FTA, with the fabricated regime of Israel. In a joint piece for The Telegraph in November, UK Foreign Secretary Liz Truss came together with the Zionist regime's foreign minister Yair Lapid to celebrate the prospect of transforming a close relationship into an even closer partnership through a new strategic plan for the next decade, spanning cyber, tech, trade and so-called defense. On March 29th, UK chief negotiator for the agreement, James Clark, appealed directly to readers of the London-based Jewish Chronicle to help shape discussions ahead of a new bilateral trade agreement. Both of these pieces provide a telling indication of how the British government intends to negotiate this trade deal, namely without consideration of the broader political and human rights context and without factoring in or actively consulting with all of the communities who stand to be affected by this deal, most notably Palestinians, whether in Palestine or in the UK. The British government's promotion of an enhanced trade deal is perhaps unsurprising. The current UK-Israeli regime relationship is worth almost £5 billion, and yet the deepening ties with the fabricated regime of Israel, while it continues to impose its system of control over the Palestinians and persistently violates international law, is not only morally and legally questionable, but short-sighted. The Zionist regime's violations of international law have been well documented over almost three quarters of a century. Numerous UN resolutions, legal opinions, and international reports confirm the illegality of the Zionist regime's settlements, enterprises, and associated violations, a position at least formally reflected in UK foreign policy. As the Israeli regime routinely announces the expansion of settlements throughout the entirety of the territory between the Mediterranean Sea and Jordan River, it also continues to fully integrate those settlements, including the production and manufacturing industries, financial services, and many other types of business that profit from the expropriation of Palestinian land and resources. A free trade deal would effectively help to maintain this illegal situation. An FTA in this context also stands to make British businesses and citizens complicit in human rights abuses, despite commitments made by the British government to the UN Guiding Principles on Business and Human Rights through its National Action Plan. It also sends a message to the Zionist regime that not only will the continued killing, maiming, forced expulsions, residency revocations, mass political incarcerations, and denial of rights of Palestinians be tolerated by the UK, but materially rewarded. A prospective FTA is only one for a number of ways in which the message is being projected by this British government. Voting against recent UN Human Rights Council resolutions on Palestinian self-determination and Israeli settlements, in stark contrast to the international consensus, and opposing the investigation of the International Criminal Court into the Zionist regime war crimes, serve to actively shield the fake regime of Israel from accountability. The continued failure of the British government to challenge the Zionist regime's criminalization of six human rights organizations condemned by UN experts as a frontal attack not only on Palestinian human rights but on human rights everywhere and fully at odds with the UK commitment to human rights defenders provides yet another indication of this position. And the British government has still to show any signs of meaningfully engaging with an ever-growing body of evidence from Palestinian and international human rights organizations, most recently Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and the UN Special Rapporteur, that the Zionist regime's laws, policies and practices meets the legal definition of apartheid. In a post-Brexit era, Britain has an opportunity to be a leader in negotiating diplomatic relationships based on respect for human rights and the rule of law. Continuously failing to hold the fake regime of Israel accountable to universal standards calls into question the British government's own commitment to these principles and its credibility on the international stage, particularly at a time when international law and mechanisms are being invoked in other contexts and trade and diplomacy are being used as tools to promote accountability in other parts of the world. Fundamentally, signing a free trade agreement at this time would send a clear message that continued settlement expansion, annexation, and apartheid are actions to be rewarded rather than to be held to account. Without conditionality on human rights or any other mechanisms for accountability, how can an enhanced trading relationship be understood by the Israeli regime, or indeed any other state actors observing this deal, as anything other than support for legal violations and war crimes? And as the balance of power tips further in favor of the perpetrator of these violations, how can this move achieve anything but take us yet further from a just future for all?
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. Former U.S. President Donald Trump sponsored the so-called Abraham Accords between Israel, the United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain, promising peace nearly 2 years ago. Sudan and Morocco followed their lead shortly afterwards. Since then, Saudi Arabia has been the silent party and the virtual signatory to the normalization process, waiting for the right moment to make its position public. But it seems like the two sides are showing their tendencies for normalization more overtly, with the Israeli President Isaac Herzog openly stating in a recent interview that he wishes to visit the kingdom, calling for normalization with Riyadh. The Israeli president, other than that, has also called for visiting the kingdom. And now word is that the Israeli private plane, an Israeli private plane actually, has also landed in the Saudi capital. In this edition of The Spotlight, we discuss why both Tel Aviv and Riyadh are beating the drums of normalization at this point in time. And we will try to shed light actually on the different aspects of this.
Israel and Saudi Arabia have no diplomatic relations officially. But for years, extensive behind-the-scenes diplomatic and intelligence cooperation between Tel Aviv and Riyadh has been open secret. Now, it seems that curtains are falling off of the covert relationship. Israeli media have revealed that an Israeli aircraft landed in an airport in Saudi Arabia's capital, Riyadh, late on Monday. The private plane reportedly took off from Tel Aviv. But this is not the first time that this has happened. Last October, another Israeli private jet landed in Riyadh, making it the first time a public flight from Israel has ever landed in a kingdom. This is the latest among improving regional ties for Israel after agreements to normalize ties with four nations, namely the UAE, Bahrain, Morocco, and Sudan, were reached in the 2020 Abraham Accords. Tel Aviv and Riyadh opened their airspaces to each other in 2020. Apart from that, Israeli and Saudi officials have recently openly talked about normalizing ties. Last month, Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman said Riyadh does not look at Israel as an enemy. He went on to describe Israel as a potential ally with many common interests. Saudi Foreign Minister Faisal bin Farhan al-Saud has also recently told a Hebrew language newspaper that the integration of Israel in the region will be a huge benefit not only for Israel, but for the entire region. Israeli President Isaac Herzog on Monday said in an interview that he likes to visit Saudi Arabia openly and called on Riyadh to join the Abraham Accords and normalize its ties with the regime. In November 2020, it was reported that the then Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had secretly visited Saudi Arabia. The warming up of ties comes amid the escalation of tensions in the occupied territories. Israel has increased its raids on Al-Aqsa Mosque in recent weeks and attacks Palestinian towns and cities almost every day. Palestinians have increased their operations in response to the crackdown. They have conducted several stabbing and shooting operations, including one in Tel Aviv in the past 2 months, leaving over a dozen Israelis dead. Palestinian response to the previous normalization deals has been clear, that it has not helped the resolution of the long-standing conflict in any meaningful way, and that Israeli brutalities, killings, house demolitions, land grabs and desecration of their sanctities have continued regardless. To them, resistance remains the only path leading to the liberation of the occupied territories.
Now, in order to continue this discussion, we are joined by Kevin Barrett, author and Middle East expert, who's joining us live from Madison. And also Brian Terrell, political commentator and peace activist, who's joining us from Molloy.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen for joining us. Let's begin with Mr. Barrett. Now, the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman has openly stated that Riyadh no longer views Tel Aviv as an enemy and has even come to regard the occupying regime as a potential ally. Also, Saudi Foreign Minister Faisal bin Farhan al-Saud recently welcomed the prospect of Israeli regime's integration into the region. Does this signal normalization ties anytime soon, or are politicians just testing the waters to see if the time is right?
Well, that's a good question, and I don't have any inside information allowing me to answer it. But what I can say is that when Saudi Arabia threatens to essentially embrace the genocidal Zionist entity and thereby endorse the destruction of Palestine, the desecration of the world's oldest, most important Islamic architectural monument, the Masjid al-Aqsa, which the Zionists are planning to demolish so they can build a blood sacrifice temple, this is complete treason to the Islamic world. It's one thing when countries like Sudan and Morocco and so on off at the peripheries commit this kind of treason. It's unfortunate, but it doesn't go to the heart of things in terms of the Muslim Ummah. But the Saudis are the usurpers who claim to be protecting the Haramain, the crucial center of Islamic worship. And they're therefore obliged to defend Islam, which is under attack by the Zionists. The Zionists declared war on the religion of Islam and all Muslims in the world when they invaded and occupied and committed genocide in Palestine, which has been Muslim-administered holy land for all three Abrahamic religions essentially ever since Islam existed. So this is sheer treason, and it's going, if it happens, if this normalization goes through, every Muslim on earth is going to have to go to war with these usurping bandits in Riyadh.
Exactly. And Mr. Terrell, one of the reasons Saudi Arabia has so far preferred to stay in the shadows is the fact that it was the only Arab country whose name is associated with the peace initiative that was adopted as a pan-Arab idea for permanent peace. What has changed now for the Saudis? Why don't they see any reason to hide their true intentions?
Well, I think the as a peace activist, of course, I would love to be able to celebrate people getting together and talking and settling their differences, if that's what this is. But I think that this is more akin to rival gangs sitting down and dividing the spoils and setting their turfs. The word normalization that's been said over and over again at present would be to normalize a intolerable criminal situation that should not be allowed to continue. The normalization of relations between these countries and Israel is not only normalizing the continued occupation of Palestine, but it's normalizing the violence that's been seen, especially these last days, normalizing war and oppression, and it's normalizing conditions in Saudi Arabia and in Bahrain that are making hell for the life of the people who live in those countries as well. I think this is any plea for peace, any agreements need to be made not by the princes and the oligarchs and the warlords. We just saw that in the Doha talks that happened about Afghanistan, where the people most affected by these, by the talks that the Taliban and the United States government had, were not represented, were not at the table. Any kind of peace talks, any kind of agreement. And Prime Minister Herzog the other day invited not just the Saudis to join the accords, but the Abrahamic family to join the family. It's being played as a family, but the Palestinians don't have a voice there. The people of Yemen don't have a voice there. The common people of Saudi Arabia and the common people of Bahrain and the UAE, who are very politically repressed, who have suffer under tremendous human rights abuses themselves, have no place at this table. So I think what we're seeing is a normalization of a violent, very scary kind of situation. And it's going to be for the people who are running Saudi Arabia, for the people who are running Israel, for the arms dealers, this will be, this may be a very happy event. And they... But for the people living in these regions, for the common folk, they have nothing to celebrate from this.
Exactly. They don't have anything to celebrate. And whenever we talk about Israel, it's just indispensable to talk about the U.S. So, Mr. Barrett, the Israeli ambassador to the U.S. has said, and I'm quoting him, it would be very important for our region if the U.S. and Saudi Arabia were to fix their relationship. Why is it so important?
Well, it seems that the Saudis currently have managed to get some distance between themselves and Washington, D.C. in general, and the Biden regime in particular. The Saudis were in the pocket of Trump, or vice versa, I guess, during the Trump administration. And the Trump administration made all kinds of moves that are perhaps somewhat correctly, or at least understandably, viewed as totally insane by the majority of imperial strategists here in the belly of the beast. And so the Biden administration is not so enthusiastic about these Zionist extremist projects. It would not have put the U.S. embassy in occupied Jerusalem al-Quds. It wouldn't have totally 100% endorsed and normalized the occupation, and it certainly wouldn't have pushed these idiotic so-called Abraham Accords on the region. So there's a difference in thinking between the lunatic neoconservatives around Trump, people like Pompeo and Bolton, and the really almost equally bad people, but slightly more sophisticated and slightly more rational people around Biden. So there's that issue. The Israelis, I think, are now signaling that they're all in on the war on Ukraine. We just had this brouhaha over the supposed anti-Semitism of the totally reasonable thing said by Lavrov. And that's a signal that the Israelis are jumping on board with the Ukraine bandwagon. And they would probably like to do that as part of an imperial alliance. Zionists are actually the senior partners, not the junior partners, in the imperial alliance of the Anglo-Zionist empire, the NATO states. That's because they have such important people, key finance people, and people owning the journalism industry throughout the West. So the Zionists want to keep the empire together on the same page, and they want their absurd Trumpian extremism to be the order of the day and recognized even by the relatively more reasonable, at least on that issue, people in D.C. So the Zionists, I guess, are trying to rally the so-called fake West, this alleged collective, what do they call it, the collective international community or whatever, that's really just the Anglo-Zionist empire run by oligarchs who are predominantly or at least disproportionately ethnically Jewish, these billionaires who are primarily loyal to Israel and then are willing to be semi-loyal to those countries that slavishly serve Israel's interests, like the entire all of Western Europe, the United States, Canada, and Australia. And so they want to keep that empire together and on the same radical Zionist page. And unfortunately, they may succeed.
So in other words, you're saying that the Israelis are concerned that tensions between the Biden administration and Saudi Arabia might push the Saudis towards Russia and China and even maybe better relations with Iran. Why do you think they would want to counter that?
Well, that's a step towards the end of the empire's dreams of conquering the entire world. And what we're seeing right now in the war on Russia, which is what the supposed invasion of Ukraine really is, it's a NATO war of aggression against Russia, is an attempt to pick off one of the three key links in this new emerging multipolar world of China, Russia, and Iran. China is the biggest. Iran is the most principled and the pioneer of pushing for a sovereign, independent, multipolar world. And now Russia is the one with all of the nuclear weapons and the military prowess. And so the Americans are trying to destroy the Russian wing of this multipolar alliance. At one point, we thought they would go after Iran first. And then at another point, we thought they might be going after China. And they, of course, they did when they attacked China with the COVID strike in Wuhan. That's another story. But yeah, they're afraid that the Saudis might drift out of this empire, make friends with the Russians and the Chinese. And the Israelis don't want that because they know this Western empire is what keeps their Zionist project going.
Okay, so Mr. Terrell, how do you think Israelis are going to try and counter that? What are the strategies that they might have in mind?
Well, I don't know that the situation is as sophisticated as all of that. I think that Israel is certainly wanting to maintain its hold on Palestine and its place of power in the region. But I think as far as the United States is concerned, I think it's just almost pure business. Anything that can stock, that can stir the pot, anything that can raise more money for the weapons manufacturers, totally divorced from ideology or any kind of big plan. It's making a quick buck right now, and anything that can make for more war and more disorder is what the United States is trying to do. The space, the distance between the Biden administration and the Saudis has been totally rhetorical. I mean, this was President Biden, as a candidate, mouthed what all the civilized world is saying about the Saudi war on Yemen, and used all the words that the rest of us use about a humanitarian disaster and a war crime, and insisted it was all going to stop. His first address, public address on foreign relations, promised that the aid to Saudi, the military aid and arms sales to Saudi Arabia would stop. And immediately, you know, within months, there was billions of dollars worth of weapons from Raytheon that were sold to the Saudis. So I think that's just a cover. And I think all of this, too, if there were an accord, if there were a meeting of the leaders of these countries that actually was going to bring about permanent peace, I think the United States would certainly be on the behest of the arms manufacturers. They would sabotage that. They would not let that happen for a minute. This is not a matter of permanent peace. You know, this is our, I'm afraid, our country's bent on normalizing permanent war, wars that are not supposed to, clearly not supposed to be ever ended or settled or even won, but to be continuous. And I think that the Ukraine situation now is offering a huge opportunity for the military-industrial complex that the United States is not going to miss, not let it go by.
Very interesting point you mentioned that, because the so-called Abraham Accords claimed to be about peace. Mr. Barrett, how successful have they been in bringing peace to the occupied territories in particular, especially keeping in mind the atrocities of Israelis against the Palestinian worshippers just a few weeks ago in Al-Aqsa Mosque?
Well, these so-called Abraham Accords, which really have nothing to do with the Abrahamic religions, what they are is a dirty deal between Zionist gangsters and the gangsters running a handful of these other countries in the region. And they're not successful they haven't been successful at all in bringing peace. On the contrary, it's been bloody business as usual in occupied Palestine as the repression continues unabated. There's been no change whatsoever in the existential genocidal war on the Palestinian people by the Zionists. And this is kind of surprising, even to me. I mean, I'm cynical, and I knew that the Saudis and their partners in crime were probably being mostly rhetorical when they said that as we're coming into these accords, you know, we're expecting that the Zionists will start making steps towards peace with the Palestinians, blah, blah, blah. But nothing in that direction has happened, nothing whatsoever. There hasn't been the slightest move of one micrometer towards peace from the Zionist side in Palestine. If anything, they're accelerating their genocide just throughout the entire holy month of Ramadan, which just ended, and Eid Mubarak to everyone. The Zionists were brutally attacking worshipers in the Al-Aqsa Mosque on a regular basis. They were shooting people down and killing several Palestinians a day, as they always do. None of this has slowed, and there's been no move to come up with any even reasonable framework for actual peace in Palestine. So this whole idea that it's a peace agreement is a complete joke. And I agree with the other guests that a lot of the impetus for this horrible situation is the military-industrial complex and the folks who are making money off it, I think we have to keep in mind that there is also a strategic dimension to that. That is the reason that the empire is constantly at war and willing to let the arms manufacturers help push this policy of perpetual war and destruction, is that it serves the strategic interests of the empire, because right now the rest of the world is catching up with the West in terms of economic output and technology and productivity. And if everything continues in that vein, the Western empire will be eclipsed within a couple of decades at most. So they have to destroy. They have to kill. They have to stop the global economy from growing. They have to spread COVID and attack China and Wuhan with COVID. They have to start World War III in Ukraine. They need to blow up the planet and kill and kill and kill in order to prevent the eclipse of the unipolar empire and the rise of a multipolar empire. That's the strategic plan behind the apparent profiteering of the military-industrial complex, which just seems to be running everything so it can make money. No, there is a strategic plan behind it, and it's an evil one.
So, Mr. Tara, I can see that you agree with Mr. Barrett. If you could please elaborate, what do you think is the true nature of these Abraham Accords? Is it more about building an anti-Iran coalition and sidelining the oppressed Palestinians, maybe?
Yeah, it's about sidelining not only the people, the Palestinians, but the people of Bahrain and the people of Saudi Arabia, the people of Yemen. It's to call this a peace accord is really obscene. It's a plan for, again, maintaining, for normalizing what should never be normal, what should never be tolerated at all. I think that too, we're on the edge of, I agree with some of what the other guests said, and I think that we're at a very, very scary time, and rather than lose this empire, which is, we're willing to risk all life on Earth. We're closer to a nuclear war, according to the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists now, than we ever were during the Cold War. And in recent years, we've had both the United States, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, in a paper released in 2019, was touting the new nuclear weapons that are being produced here as being more flexible, more easily deployable, and saying that with these new nuclear weapons, the United States can be able to prevail on the battlefield. The whole notion of mutually assured destruction, the sword of Damocles, as President Kennedy called it, over all of our heads, threatening us every day, whatever kind of protection that may have given us over the years, we have now, there isn't, the mutually assured destruction is not mutually assured anymore. We have the United States, and then now Russia has, just in recent months, been talking about raising the idea that perhaps they could win a nuclear war. This absolutely insane idea that a nuclear war can be winnable, which no one suggested that for many, many years, for decades, has reemerged. And I think this may be a the world headed toward destruction, rather than as the other guest said, rather than give up the unipolar hegemony, we'd rather end the whole thing. And it's a very, very frightening time, and we need real peace accords. We need real people sitting down and not sidelining the big issues. Yes, if only the Saudis and Israel and UAE and Bahrain could be sitting down with the United States and with Russia and with Iran and be talking about what would be a just solution. But we're not doing that. That's not what's happening.
Exactly, Mr. Tara. I'm sorry, we're running out of time. I had to cut you off. That was Mr. Brian Tara, political commentator and peace activist out of Malloy, and Kevin Barrett, author and a Middle East expert out of Madison. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen for sharing your thoughts with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره، همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali عليه السلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being. A brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام أصدقاؤك ثلاثة وأعداؤك ثلاثة فأصدقاؤك صديقك وصديق صديقك وعدو عدوك وأعداؤك عدوك وعدو صديقك وصديق عدوك.
Imam Ali stated, "Your friends are three and your enemies are three. Your friends are your friend, your friend's friend, and your enemy's enemy. And your enemies are your enemy, your friend's enemy, and your enemy's friend." Dear friends, it's a blessing to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we're discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, alayhi salam. Dear friends, we find that in the universal persona of this first divinely appointed Imam, this Imam who was selected and chosen by the Almighty Allah, and of course who can be said to be the living miracle